I'm Anthony Wright, and I'm your host today on Attunement. Today, my guest is poet Diane Frank.
I love language. I love words. They're like pain. They're music. And when I write, I want every line of a poem to be as powerful as possible, as beautiful as possible, because I think that poetry comes often from the best or the most challenging situations in life. So you want that really intense, powerful, gorgeous language to express those feelings.
Diane Frank is an award-winning poet. Her friends describe her as a harem of seven women in one very small body. She has mentored hundreds of writers at San Francisco State University, City College of San Francisco, the University of Vermont, and a professional writing program at MIU in Fairfield, Iowa. Currently, she lives in San Francisco, where we are actually interviewing her today. You'll be able to hear the foghorn in the background and a dinner party going on downstairs. Her book, Blackberries in the Dream House, her first novel, was nominated for the Pulitzer Prize. That must have been really remarkable.
I couldn't even talk about it for the first few months after I found out.
Wow. Tell us about Blackberries in the Dream House.
Blackberries in the Dream House is a forbidden love story about a geisha and a Buddhist monk in Kyoto 150 years ago. I wrote it in the genre of magical realism, which means that extraordinary things can happen in the waking state, and it's definitely a higher love story. It's erotic and metaphysical.
And it seems to actually, I don't know that I can make an accurate comparison with a book like Kurt Vonnegut of Slaughterhouse-Five, but there seems to be a lot of transtemporal momentum between the geisha and the monk that she loves.
Oh, beyond space and time. Don't you think that love is always that way when it's real?
Yes, yes. You actually went to Japan to study the background for that novel, didn't you? And you said, as I recall in one of our conversations, that you spent some time with a geisha. Is that right?
Well, I was mentored by a famous geisha in Kyoto, but I'd like to back up a little bit and tell you how the book came into being, and then I'll tell you about going to Kyoto, because it was really a remarkable experience. After my last book of poems was published, not the one that just got published, Entering the Word Temple, but The Winter Life of Shooting Stars, my grandma Helen said to me, "Diane, I don't understand poetry. Could you write me a novel?" And I said, "Sure, Grandma, I'll write you a novel," even though at the time I didn't know what the book would be about. I don't know how it is for other writers, but I feel that the story I tell in Blackberries in the Dream House chose me. It began with a powerful deja vu in my bathtub while I was still living in Iowa. The tiles turned deep blue, and I felt like I was in Kyoto in a public bath during the late Edo period, which is about 150 years ago. And then the story started coming and kept coming and coming until it was told. Since I'm primarily trained as a poet, I had two rules when I was writing. One extended metaphor per chapter, and every sentence has to be beautiful. I work the language line by line the same way that I work a poem. And so there were a few stages in the writing of Blackberries. The first was this deja vu, and then the story just started telling itself to me. When I was partway through it, I started doing a lot of research. You know, I read everything I could about Japan and the geisha community, and, you know, I already had a background in Japanese ink painting from my writing for the LA County Museum of Art, and I had already studied Zen Buddhism, and I teach meditation, so I had that background. But I needed, you know, the structure of the geisha community, streets, shrines, place names. So I did a lot of research, and the interesting thing was that as I did my research, I never had to change anything in the novel. I just added things.
That's very cool.
It was like when I was writing it, it was like this extended deja vu where I was in an altered state of consciousness most of the time for 11 months. Whenever I was writing, I was just there. And so then I wrote it, you know, with the research. And before I did the final draft, even though there was just a strong feeling inside me, I felt that I needed to go to the geisha community in Kyoto and spend some time there and really see what that was like. I was at the time teaching in the professional writing program at MIU in Fairfield, Iowa. And I had, there were a lot of foreign students, and I had a student from Japan named Izumi Nakamura. And I didn't know it at the time, but poetry was her favorite class, and I was her favorite teacher. I didn't find that out until I got to Japan. But we started sending each other faxes. I didn't have email yet at the time. I told Izumi that I wanted to go to Japan, and since I'd never been to Japan and didn't speak Japanese, I wondered if I could maybe visit her for a day or two before I went to Kyoto. So she faxed me back and said that I should stay with her family, and she would arrange my trip. And
amazing.
I mean, it was amazing. And I didn't know before I got there that in Japan, people revere their teachers. I didn't know that I was Izumi's favorite teacher. So when I got there, I was treated like an honored guest. For the first week, we stayed in Izumi's sister's house, and a really beautiful in a suburb of Tokyo. And Izumi, I mean, she's an artist. She's a poet. She plays piano. She sings. She takes no drama classes, and is a very deeply spiritual person. Really beautiful face. Her face is like these ancient Japanese sculptures that you see in the shrines. Just a very classic traditional Japanese face. And she describes herself as a traditional woman. When we went to Kyoto, she wore a kimono for 3 days, which was very, very beautiful. And she's just very happy in doing that. And she also likes Shinto better than she likes Buddhism because it's older and she feels it's closer to the earth and closer to the goddess. Well, anyhow, Izumi took most of 3.5 weeks off from work. Every day she would wake up and say, well, what could we do that's beautiful today? And we would do it. I just totally let her plan everything because I knew that if I just let her do what she wanted to do, it would be a beautiful day and a special day and remarkable things would happen. There were certain people that she wanted me to meet because she felt they were spiritual or artistic. She arranged for me to be the speaker at a couple of gatherings of spiritual people, which is really interesting. And they started, like in Iowa, I had to always keep a low profile, but they would ask me questions like, okay, well, you write about angels in your poems and your books. Tell us about angels. So, you know, I would tell them what I knew, you know, that sort of thing, you know. And also the Japanese take reincarnation for granted. Everyone believes in it. So there was a sense among the people that I met that I was returning to Japan. I mean, I'm a lot smaller physically than a lot of American women. So, you know.
There was a very strong identification there then by them.
Oh, yeah.
In welcoming you. I mean, what a wonderful thing.
It was amazing. And she took me like to her Aikido master. And he said to me, well, how does it feel to be in Japan again? And her no-drama sensei, same thing, you know. Also the geisha that mentored me, she felt that I was returning to the geisha community.
Can you tell us more about what it was like to go into that extended state of altered consciousness? When you write, do you go into an extended state of consciousness?
Well, what happens when I write is that It's a very joyful process for me. It's never been the struggling writing thing that I'm in kind of an altered state of consciousness. My thoughts slow down. They become musical and imagistic. And like something comes from a very deep part of my soul.
How do you prepare for that?
Oh, I don't. I just open it up and there it is. I've been doing this for a long time. You know, I have 2 degrees in writing. And, you know, in the beginning, you know, writing wasn't so easy. I think one of the reasons I can teach it well is that I had to learn it myself.
So it takes some time to develop this altered state.
Well, I think part of it is that I have a lot of training and years of experience writing, so it's something that's very easy for me to do.
But I mean, in the beginning, for beginning writers, it does take some time to get the experience of what it is to open up to that joyful state.
Oh, absolutely. You know, part of it is having something to say, but there's another stage where you form a relationship with language. And at a certain point, the way you say something is important as what you have to say. And I'm talking about the real poets here. I'm not talking about people that are just dabbling with it.
Tell us more about that.
Well, I would like to begin by talking about writing poetry, because poetry, for me, and for many people that write poetry, requires an intense focus on language, that you really, like William Carlos Williams said, the best possible words in the best possible order. And I love language. I love words. They're like paint. They're music. And when I write, I want every line of a poem to be as powerful as possible, as beautiful as possible, because I think that poetry comes often from the best or the most challenging situations in life. So you want that really intense, powerful, gorgeous language to express those feelings. And then for early on, my prose was not as good as my poetry, but somewhere, I think it was kind of early in the 90s, it just dawned on me that the secret to writing really beautiful prose was to work every sentence line by line the same way that I worked the language in a poem. And then, like with blackberries, the reason that people have been making such a fuss about it is because of the language. I mean, it's a higher love story. It's erotic and metaphysical. And a lot of people say that they're healed by it, or they read it. Women say that they feel deeply understood. Men say that it lets them in on the secrets of being a woman from the inside. You know, a lot of couples read it to each other in bed at night. I've been told this.
Oh, that's wonderful. Well, we're going to have to take a quick break. I'm Anthony Wright, and my guest is Diane Frank, who is a poet and an extraordinary writer. And also to let my listeners know that I have been privileged to be playing harp behind Diane in some of her recent poetry readings. And we're going to be right back. I'm Anthony Wright, and I'm your host today on Attunement. And my guest is Diane Frank, who is a poet and an extraordinary writer. In your time in Kyoto, what was it about Kyoto that was so useful in bringing reality to your writing?
Well, first, I'd like to tell you how I happened to be invited into the geisha community, because it is not a usual thing for an outsider or for any woman that isn't part of the community, that in Japan, a lot of things happen through connections and favors. And Izumi was studying no drama and singing with a no sensei, a really, really nice man. She took me to one of his classes, and as a favor to him, a friend of his in the geisha community agreed to mentor me. Now, I went to the airport. I flew to Japan. I went to Izumi's house, knowing that I'd go to Kyoto, hoping to find some sort of entrance or at least spend some time in the geisha community. And this was just an amazing thing. And first of all, when I got to Pontecho, which is the geisha district where most of my novel takes place, it was like nonstop deja vu. It was like the streets were saying, welcome home, glad to see you again. Now, Izumi felt that I should go to Pontecho, you know, just walk there, you know, eat there, spend some time there, really see what it feels like. And it gave me this real visceral feeling of how to be, what it's like to be in this extraordinary community. And also, when I was talking to Masukyo, who is the geisha who mentored me, I was able to ask her some pretty provocative questions about her life and got a lot of insight, because I think that geishas understand certain things about women and about men and about relationship that people in the West don't. And they're controversial things. Although I've talked about it in feminist bookstores and they haven't thrown me out.
Are there sorts of things you could tell our audience?
Oh, sure.
Okay.
One of them is quite feminist, actually. I asked her at one point if she had any regrets about not being married. And she said, oh, no, I was much too busy with my career. Now, this is a woman who has recorded 5 albums of traditional Japanese singing, and she's entertained, you know, like the prime minister. And she's one of these people that if a dignitary comes in and they want him to have an experience with a very refined and elegant geisha, she's one of the people that gets chosen for that. And when I was there, she was 53. On my website, I have a picture of her holding a photograph of herself as a teenage Maiko. It's just gorgeous. You know, it's a photograph that I took of her when I was there. And the other controversial question, I asked her if she, as a geisha, feels that she understands men better than other women. And she said, oh, yes. And then she was quiet. So, So I asked her if she could talk about that. And, like, I'll give it to you straight. She said, we serve men, and this is the source of our power. Now, I'm going to translate that into, like, a cross culture. Now, I find that a lot of women in this country are afraid to be devoted to a man because they feel that they will lose their power. And there's a real standoff between the sexes in many cases. Whereas in this community, the women are not afraid to be devoted. And they know how to make anyone, male or female, feel really comfortable, really respected, cared for, appreciated. And they do this from the center of their power. So I got a real living example of how to be devoted from a place of power.
I was reading parts of Blackberries this morning in preparation for this interview, and it seemed like the female character is very almost pliant, but you're saying this pliancy is from a very powerful center then.
Well, I would think so, especially by the time you get to the end of it. But I was on KPFA interviewed by Caroline Casey, and she had this really amazing insight to my novel, which I hadn't had before I was on her show. You know, I just love Caroline Casey. And she analyzed my novel as a journey with Yukiko, the geisha, from an experience with a very wonderful but uninitiated male who could not complete the journey with her, to the point where she totally lost it and went into the underworld, where she had to recreate and rediscover herself on a new level, on a deeper level. And then she came back up to complete the journey with an initiated male, Kenji, the monk. And she is totally in her power. She's at her level of mastery. You know, you don't get to a level of mastery without going through a long, hard journey. And the book is partially about that. I mean, I could even read you 2 segments of the novel that she asked me to read to point out the difference.
Please.
Well, sure. Okay. Well, the first segment would be chapter 4, which is early in the novel. Yukiko is still with Eitaro, her first love, who is the uninitiated male. She is very deeply in love with him at this point and terribly afraid of losing him. Chapter 4, Where My Breathing Whispers. Eitaro wraps me in yellow silk during a thunderstorm. He wakes me up from a dream of cicadas flying away from the feet of a kabuki dancer. He reaches for me through the song of a wooden flute, weaving through branches of rhododendron trees, blooming in the rain. Eitaro loves me like rain, like jasmine petals, like thunder. His scent is sweeter than jasmine, wild like the musk of a brown deer. I love to inhale his skin between the petals of my dreams and in the morning. He loves me like mist in the early morning, scattering dew in a garden of chrysanthemums. I wonder if these are seeds that will grow children. Sometimes Eitaro frightens me with his intensity. He storms into my house after midnight and ties my wrists with black silk ribbons. He doesn't smile. He won't let me say anything until I am filled with his rain, until my petals open to him completely. But when he sees the storm of love in my eyes, he is the one who is frightened. I don't completely understand this. Eitaro loves me from underneath my muscles, from the secret place where my breathing whispers. He plays my body like a master musician on a shakuhachi flute, a winding, weaving melody. His fingers run like deer through the forest of my body, touch me like summer rain, chrysanthemums blooming in a stone garden. He feels my energy rise, fill, become the full moon, ripple and scatter like silver fish in a koi pond. He is an artist of a lover, and he never stops until the moon is overflowing. I dance for him in the tea house and later in the dark, inside a steam of jasmine flowers. He holds me in the air, and his mouth is a lake full of kisses. But there are things that he won't talk about. If I ask him why, he puts his fingers to my mouth. He wants me to be happy, and sometimes this requires silence. In my dreams, I gather stones from the north, from a blue lake in the mountains. One of the stones is rose pink, one is silver. The stones are on my altar now. I wait for answers, but the stones are silent. The hummingbirds tell me the light will return at the time of the winter solstice. Then the stones speak, but in a cryptic language. Earth brings memory. Ocean brings renewal. I think Eitaro is someone I could dream with for the rest of my life. But maybe it's dangerous to think this way, a dream inside of a stone. He is wealthy, and I am a geisha. So that is early in the book, and, you know, before her journey into the underworld, and this kind of sets up the conflict that allows her to meet Kenji, the young monk. So now I'll read you, this is very close to the end of the book, and this is after where she's in her power, he's in his power, and This is a different kind of love. Okay, so that first experience of love is really sweet and really beautiful, very vulnerable. Now, this is what came later. Yukiko and Kenji swim in each other for hours while the moon rises higher and higher in the sky. The air is humid and full of the scent of gardenias. They are everywhere in time. They are loving each other inside the steam of the bathhouse in Pontecho. They are walking the long row of stone lanterns to the Sengen Jinja shrine at Fuji Yoshida. Kenji's voice is calling down the falling stars as they burn their path of fire across the sky. At the same time, his voice is the call to prayer, drifting out of the tower of the mosque and floating through the late afternoon. Yukiko's back is the arch of the minaret that follows the path of the horizon. When you open yourself completely to another human being, you enter a world beyond space and time, beyond the male and female boundaries of the human body. You're making love, but you're wild inside the forest, moving towards the other, but at the same time moving inward through your own layers of body and consciousness. The outer layer is your physical body. As you go deeper, the layers become less and less physical, less and less of a costume. The body is what makes you a man or a woman and determines what the experience will be. But as you move in, deeper and deeper in the forest, as you move through physical, sexual, heart, and soul, the inner sexuality, which contains both male and female, comes through. At a certain point, there is a choice. My male-female essence meets you. Your female-male essence meets me. The inner man and woman are facing each other deep inside. As a woman, my heart is open. My legs are wide and wrapped around you, and I feel the penetration. But we are so far inside each other that I feel your male essence as strongly as I feel my own. At that moment, my sexuality becomes more direct and penetrating. Like dancing, you pick it up with a look in the eye. You're in the wild forest, and it's easy. The forest is filled with bears and blossoms of rhododendron trees. The trees are filled with songbirds just after sunrise, and the melodies weave together into a larger song. We love each other completely, without hesitation. We're separate, joined, and at the center of all possibilities. This is the point of creation where, long ago, we were formed as human beings. At that point, you can choose. Let my inner woman fill you. Let your inner man fill me. I am still inside my body, but you are in me even deeper. Reach for me and pull me into your being. Pour yourself into my eyes. On the deepest altar of my heart, my emotions, and my inner light, I offer myself as a gift to you completely. I just give it, and everything changes inside. I slide into you, you slide into me. Ripples emerge where the waters meet inside. Time has dissolved, and we have entered a state of intense communion. I'm so far inside you that I don't even remember where I am. I remember making love to you in different bodies, different lives, sometimes as a man, sometimes as a woman, sometimes with my body, sometimes only with my eyes.
I'm Anthony Wright, and I'm your host today on Attunement, and we're going to take a short break. My guest today is Diane Frank, and we'll be right back. I'm Anthony Wright, and I'm your host today on Attunement, and my guest is Diane Frank. Welcome back, Diane. Well, I have to say that I'm finding myself going into that altered state of consciousness and listening to your writing, and I so much appreciate your description about how you write, and I'm hungry to know more about that, but a lot of it I have a sense of is more doing. And I'd like you to read, you've written a number of other collections of poems. There's one particular one I see that's at the top of the stack here that's called Entering the Word Temple. What would you like to say about your books?
Well, one thing I'd like to say about the creative process, since you've asked a few times, is that it's mysterious even to me. You know, I feel like Blackberries as a novel chose me, like each poem chooses me. And I feel that poetry is the language of the soul. And it's like really important. A lot of times, you know, I've read all around the country, and sometimes when I read, there's an open mic afterwards. And sometimes the poems are really wonderful. Sometimes they aren't. But what I see each time, regardless of what the poem is like, is that these poems are very, very important to the people that write them. And that's because they're expressing what is most deep within them. And poetry is a way of finding language that ordinary language cannot express.
But it does take some people to be deliberate in taking the time to read it and to hear it, wouldn't you say?
What do you mean by that?
Well, to reflect to you my own experience of reading poems without the kind of preparation. I mean, I thought to myself, well, why do people like poetry so much? And you have to be in a state of mind to be able to receive the gift of the poet. And sometimes I'm in that space, and sometimes I'm not. I'm not sure quite where I'm going with this, but...
I think I can say something about that. I think a poem is like a magic spell. It's like a parallel universe that you enter, and it works on its own terms. So you go into that. It's like going into an altered state of consciousness when you enter a poem.
But they're not really yours anymore after you write them.
Well, there was a kind of a famous line from the film The Postman, which was a film about Pablo Neruda,
right,
when the postman said, poems don't belong to the people that write them. They belong to the people that need them.
Oh, yeah.
Now,
that's great.
You know, there's a poem. I'd like to read a different poem first, but I have a poem that I kind of give out to people that I think need it. But there's a poem I feel really close to right now that's in my book, The Winter Life of Shooting Stars. In both of my novels, there's a thing going on with birds, and this is where it came from. In the voices of the birds. What I most remember about Christopher is the way he knew the names of all the birds at dawn by their songs. His corn silk blonde hair, blue overalls, no shirt, the strength of his shoulders, and the way we stayed awake all night. There was light in his touch between the birds. They flew in and out of his fingers, and birds outside our window, a window we couldn't open again that way. We met when we could after that, in Iowa, Switzerland, San Francisco, in borrowed cabins on two different oceans. You took me to my brother's wedding in a red pickup truck, made fun of the priest and my brother's future mother-in-law, which you claimed permission to do because you were Catholic. I remember the way you hurt me, what you said, and the sentence I typed on your portable Smith Corona in Nantucket before I left for the last time. It was November, with a light dusting of snow over the sand. The pebbles on the beach hid their messages. On separate sides of the continent, we listened to different oceans and slammed our lives shut. You in Brooklyn Heights with your 2-year-old son on your shoulder. Me in San Francisco, climbing the long hill to 24th Street. 12 years later, holding your first book of poems in my hands, I am hungry for memories, hungry for every word, hungry for any hint of a message where I might find myself. In the inscription, you write, there are histories in this book you may be familiar with because you were there. I am not the arms where you will rest your head when you're 80 years old, but I always hear you in the voices of the birds.
There's not much I can say after that. Oh, other than to maybe ask you to read some of the other poems that we've done that I've played behind you on our readings.
I'm going to read a poem called Waltz. This took place during the reign of Comet Hale Bob. I was at Folklore Village, which is a farm in Wisconsin that was converted into a dance community and kind of a cultural place. And during this dance weekend, a member of the band walked off the stage to waltz with me. So this is Waltz. The comet discovers a blue path over your shoulder, spinning through outer space above the wood porch railing. We are whirling to the harmonies of Star of County Down, your arm in the midheaven of my back, holding burgundy velvet. A violin is weaving through the flute, but your eyes hold me to a deeper melody. Around the borders of my seeing, your hair curls into a halo of memory. Maybe it is the full moon or the thunderclouds gathering out of season over the rolling Wisconsin cow pastures, predicting tomorrow's snow. As we circle around each other, the wind swirls over the red barn next to the 19th century schoolhouse, a terrifying beauty that will blow the walls apart. If I invite you into my house, I know you would take the time to find the trilobites and the seashell fossils, to see how the curve of the cello fits my leg. I'd watch you fold the prayers you have almost forgotten into saffron wrapped around the bare feet of the Buddha. And in your eyes, I might find the blue imprint of a comet, a message from a planet near the Pleiades, etched by a 10-year-old with a switchblade into your largest finger, an almost forgotten memory of the way back home.
It's almost like I'm hearing these for the first time. It's probably I'm not playing the harp behind them.
Right, it must be, because you know these poems, but when you're not playing harp, you can really listen to the words.
Yeah, but this is also going to inform the playing, I have to say.
Oh, that'll be good.
Oh, yeah, because before I've just been playing to the song, the music of your voice, you know. So please continue.
Oh, I will. I like reading poetry when you're playing harp because I connect very deeply with music and it allows me to feel my poems at a deeper level. But right now I'm feeling them at a deeper level too. So I come from a family of musicians. My mother sang with big bands in the 40s before I was born. This is her story and also mine. My mother's daughter. It is 5 years before I was born, before life ruined her. She is already 16 years old, breasts rising like yeasted bread, which she tries to conceal on the streets of her immigrant neighborhood. But when she sings with Tommy Dorsey's big band, she stuffs her dress with tissues, paints her lips red, and styles her hair like Judy Garland. At Wequoyoc High School, she joins the hall patrol to station herself outside the door of my father's six-period class. She's smiling every afternoon when he walks out of the door. Later, they escape to the West Village in his red convertible, to the apartment he shares with his half-brother in a loft filled with etchings. When he walks into the nightclub where she pretends to be 18 years old, she sings to my father directly with bedroom eyes, "How High the Moon," blasting out of Tommy's trombone and then cascading from her mouth. Who could resist such a song? By the subway stop to Harlem to see Billie Holiday, he buys two gardenias for her hair. A few months later, they hitchhike to a cabin by Caroga Lake in upstate New York, share a bottle of wine, throw the glasses into the fire, and create me. Years later, my mother will tell me how I ruined her career, but she has a transparent face. In the photograph, in the small apartment in Spanish Harlem where they lived after I was born, I see her completely happy. Robert Bly was a very important mentor when I was forming as a poet. I took workshops with him before he got real involved in the men's movement. And I think the first one was Greek, Norwegian, and Hindu gods and goddesses as agents of transformation in human consciousness. And he was working with the Great Mother and the New Father. And, you know, my first book of poems is called Isis, and that was the big change that happened after I started working with Robert Bly. And I also heard him tell Iron John just as a story in a workshop he did with Gioia Tempanelli. I mean, very powerful story, and, you know, which, of course, became his very famous book. On it might have been that workshop. Robert was talking about how the soldiers who came back from Vietnam had this terrible experience and then were not honored because so many people were against the war. And he was feeling that it was really important to write about this experience and honor these people. I had a friend named Jay Latham in when I was living in Fairfield, Iowa, who was like a brother to me. He was a big brother. And he was a Vietnam vet. And there was a winter that we hung out a lot, mainly because the two of us were the only people in that little town who had been to the Himalayas. We were introduced for that reason. And he was, he was a Marine. He was fiercely protective of me. I know, like, you know, I can still hear him, you know, like if I was having a bad time with a guy, he'd go, "Diane, consider the capability." And he'd say that in a beautiful North Carolina accent. You know, I really, he's not here anymore, and I really miss him. And anyway, he had this photograph in his apartment of a Japanese woman that would just rivet my attention. So one day, I walked into his apartment, and I said, "Jay, who is she?" So this is the story he told me. Photograph from Okinawa. In the photograph, she is coming down the stairs from the bathhouse where she lives. You are the 19-year-old Marine from North Carolina whose words flow into her ears like an exotic song from the other side of a mystery. You are tall, handsome, and the wide muscles of your arms push into the seams of your shirt before you scatter your uniform on her tatami floor. She is lost in the cornflower blue of your eyes as you rock her narrow bed and fill the halls of the bathhouse with cat sounds. And in the geisha curves of her perfect island body, you are trying to forget the daylight of the military base where you don't have a voice. When you ask her to smile for the photograph, you don't notice the way her eyes are glazing over the pain she feels every time she remembers the soldier who went to Vietnam and exploded one afternoon in the middle of the jungle in a cloud of orange fire. And you are unaware that moments before you leave this island for the last time, she will try to fold herself in your suitcase. A week later, two of your friends will tell you that they found her at midnight running naked down the street. When they bring her back to the bathhouse, she will dream she is 8 years old, trying to dig a tunnel to North Carolina with a silver spoon. She has no idea that 20 years later, after your round-eye wife breaks all of your dishes and walks out of your house for the last time, after your next girlfriend is dragged out of her apartment in Manhattan, tied up and thrown into a suitcase, after 5 pilgrimage journeys to holy places in the Himalayas at altitudes beyond where the people you've left behind can breathe, and the other woman you have finally come to love walks out of your house for the last time and won't even answer your phone calls, you will find her photograph. She doesn't know that you worship her now inside a golden frame beside your paintings of bodhisattvas and holy stones from the Ganges River. She has no idea how much you loved her, and you didn't either at the time. I had a really interesting experience after I wrote this poem, because every poem has text and subtext. Text is what is on the page, subtext is what is underneath, and the text is obviously the story about my friend Jay, and underneath, this poem was telling me something about myself that I hadn't gotten for 10 years. So I finished the poem and started sobbing, and it wasn't about Jay.
I'm Anthony Wright, and I'm your host today on Attunement, and we're going to take a short break. My guest today is Diane Frank, and we'll be right back. I'm Anthony Wright, and I'm your host today on Attunement, and my guest is Diane Frank. I've actually taken an online workshop with you, and could you tell us about the poetry workshops that you offer from time to time?
I taught here in San Francisco at San Francisco State University and City College, and then was recruited by a small experimental university in Iowa that blends Eastern and Western philosophy. I taught there for 16 years, and in the professional writing workshop, I taught graduate-level poetry, script writing, book writing and marketing. And in 2002, the university was changing its image, downsized, and just ended the program that I was teaching. You know, just presto, change-o, no job. And, you know, just very suddenly. So the good news about that is that it gave me the opportunity to move back to San Francisco and recreate my life. You know, like for about 3 days, I felt like a truck had run over me, which I think is understandable. That weekend, I was signed up for a dance workshop in Lexington, Kentucky, the dance trance and the contra dance community. You know, first night, there was a lot of truck and a little bit of dancing. Second day morning, you know, dancing truck, dancing truck, dancing truck, you know. By the afternoon, I was getting into that really joyful place that I get into when I dance, you know. And by the third day, I was just from that joyful place thinking of all sorts of possibilities for my future. You know, when I was on book tour with Blackberries, I was like looking around different places where I might like to live. But I decided to come back home, which is San Francisco. So, you know, and one of the things was I wanted to take some time off from university teaching so that I could pay more attention to my writing, because teaching is just, it's pure giving, it's selfless service. And I decided that I wanted to maybe give some of that to myself. So, you know, the first thing, Blackberries in the Dream House, was published 10 months after I lost my job. And I was going to take a leave of absence, but that had already been created for me. So I went touring with the book for close to a year and a half. And then while I was on book tour, I started writing a second novel. So, you know, I decided that I wanted to finish that novel before I would look for a university job again. But I really didn't want to stop teaching. So what I did, I came up with this idea for an online poetry workshop. You know, one of the things I do is sort of on the side. I think a lot of poets are jugglers, and you kind of piece it together and do various things to support yourself and hopefully not full time so that you have time to write. Well, I came up with this idea for doing an online workshop. I am chief editor of Blue Light Press, which is a collective of poets, but I'm sort of the major ringleader of the group. So I decided, you know, since a lot of people contact me and I had all this whole email list, I decided that I would do an online workshop. I would do an 8-week session. I started out just, you know, 8 weeks, but it ended up being 8 weeks three times a year. So I do a fall, winter, and spring workshop. And I do it in a series of emails. The first day, I send out 5 emails. The first is the introduction to the graduate writing course I used to teach. You know, it's going to be like a first chapter of a book, so I send it out with like a copyright thing, you know. But, you know, it's a really juicy, provocative, helpful introduction to poetry, you know, what poetry really is, why people love it so much, lots of quotes, 10 tools to become a better poet. And, you know, because one of the things about being a poet, if you're really going to be good, you have to work language. It's not just about having something to say. It's about having just an exquisite, powerful relationship with language that you can access when you want to express yourself. And So I do that. I have a way of workshopping poems, which is very positive. I don't believe in nailing people against the wall. You know, I've been nailed against the wall repeatedly because I have 2 degrees in poetry. But, you know, I realize that the teachers that I really learn the most from, like Stephen Dunn, you know, Kathleen Frazier, Dan Langton at San Francisco State, they were the poets that were really into me and what I was writing. And my way is like you praise first, and you're very generous with the praise. And then after the poet's really secure with what works about the poem, you make suggestions. You make them gently, you make them kindly. And the poet, I advise poets to just take the suggestions that are helpful and discard the rest. Because if you're in a workshop, you're going to get good and bad suggestions. So I give people my workshopping method. I give them a template. I give them a, you know, a list of books, poems that I love in case they want to read, because I think reading poetry is important if you're writing it. And then I give them the first seed idea. Now, every week I give the poets a provocative, juicy seed idea. And the poets can use it, or if there's something that they're obsessed with, they can write about something else. But I feel it's my job to provide one good idea a week. But here's the neat thing. Okay, so I do this through emails. The poet, you know, writes a poem, sends it to everybody in the group. People give comments, you know, send them to everybody in the group. So it gets really wild. And then towards the end of the week, I will, and after people have received comments from everyone else, I will get back into the poem and just line by line let the poet know what works and every opportunity I see for them to transform the poem and make it better. And, you know, and I'm not attached to my, you know, suggestions either. I just give them. You know, I spend a lot of time. I actually, the poets get more time and attention on their poems than they used to get when I had a group of people in a room, because, you know, I'm just there sitting with it for a while. Although I have to say that I do like live interaction. I love leading groups of poets. And at some point, and I hope some point soon, I would like to be teaching at a university again. You know, and if anybody is listening that happens to know a good place that I should be teaching at the university level, get in touch with Anthony at the station, because, you know, this is a public announcement to myself and everyone that I want to start teaching again at a university in this area.
Sure, and people can contact you at your website.
Yeah. My website is www.dianefrank.net. My email is geishapoet@aol.com. And when, you know, anyone who reads my books and sends, I like to know what people think, and I answer all of my letters and email. I think that if someone writes to me and has really taken the time and care to let me know what their experience was with my book and how the book speaks to them, that they deserve an answer. And that's how I work. And my strong desire when anybody reads any of my poems or my novel is that the book will have a gift for them, that it'll speak deeply for them.
Well, I'm afraid we're out of time, and thank you so much for being with us, Diane. And I'm Anthony Wright, and I've been your host today on Attunement. If you want to go to my website and check out other shows from this series, you can go to www.attunement.biz. That's attunement.biz. And thank you for listening, and see you next time.